What is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. I'm your host, Curry Blanford, and today I'm talking to Mako. So this interview is exactly what I think I needed for the new year, and I hope what you need for this new year. It is an episode just full of hope in the new creation, which is where we should be placing our hope. And in this episode, we talk about art and faith. Mako has just recently released a book, which you should definitely read, called Art and Faith, A Theology of Making, just about this concept of the necessity of art and why we need art. And Mako makes the case that we need art because it is not utilitarian. It is not useful and therefore necessary. And I think it's just it's a really important topic to talk about, especially as we are in this time of just still struggling in so many different ways. We need hope. We need hope in a new creation and a creator that creates good things. And this book brings that to the fore. This episode, we talk about the utilitarianism of our society, where things are only valuable if they're useful, and how the gospel really pushes back on that and how art pushes back on that. And so you're just going to get a lot out of this episode. I can't wait for you to hear it. Before we get into the interview, I just want to remind you to make sure you're following me on Instagram and Facebook at Theology of Hustle, and on Twitter at Curry Blanford. You can also check out my YouTube channel called Bootleg Bible College, which is just about the basics of Bible and theology for you to understand in simple ways. And so I hope you check out all that, and I really hope you enjoy hearing from Mako. All right, well, Mako, thanks so much for joining me on the podcast. It's super fun to meet you and get to talk a little bit.
Yeah, it's great to be on this podcast. Thanks.
Awesome. So let's just start off by maybe just having you introduce yourself to everybody a little bit.
So I'm an artist, and I've always been an artist, and everything comes out of my studio for me, writing, speaking, lecturing. Even when I lecture, I try to invoke what I do in the studio, which has often been called slow art. Okay. You know, David Brooks of New York Times said, you know, my way of my working is kind of an antidote, kind of an internet cleanse, because it forces not only me to slow down, but for the viewer to slow down as well. And that's an interesting observation. But what I do is I paint, but I use very traditional way of painting that is Japanese and called Nihonga. And I was born in the States, and I, my father is a renowned scientist, and we ended up in Sweden after Boston. Mm-hmm. He was doing his postdoc work with Noam Chomsky then, went to Sweden, and then taught at Tokyo University. And so I was in Japan for my grade school years, and then came back to the famed laboratory called Bell Labs in Murray Hill, where I spent middle school and high school. And then I went back to Japan for graduate school, and I wanted to particularly learn the technique and method of Nihonga, Japanese style paintings that harken back to 8th century Japan, pulverized minerals, gold, silver, silk, paper, you name it. But I what I do is contemporary art, so my work tends to be large, sometimes monumental, and they create kind of an immersive experience. And I do these collaborational work with sound and music as well. But everything I do, my new book, Art and Faith, A Theology of Making, is literally observation coming out of the studio of observing what the Bible has to say about nature, creativity, and in fact, I call the creator God of the Bible as the only true artist who can make something out of nothing, you know? So, yeah. So that's kind of who I am. I've written many books. Surprisingly, I've always wrote when I was painting, because there's a nice rhythm to it. I ended up with what turns out to be my fourth book now. And this is really my life work, though. The work that's coming out of Yale Press is really something that I've been thinking and writing about for a long time. It's in fact 1/3 of what I've actually written. We find it for Seiko our readers. and so that's the book.
I love it. I think that's awesome. And I love the art and faith discussion. There's so many aspects to it. I'm curious though. I love to talk about story, and I think God shapes us through our stories to our vocation, right? Like uses all of those in, those roads and those winding paths. So, I mean, you have a father who's a scientist, you know, that's a very different sort of genre than I think most people would think of art. So what was it that first drew you to art, and like, how did that play out?
So the interesting thing is my father never thought they were separate or too distinct. You know, obviously there are different spheres of categories, but he always considered what he did as a pure scientist, research scientist, creative work. He talked often about sound, especially sound research, acoustics research, which he was in, being very highly intuitive. And of course, Bell Labs was known for the early stages of AI research with speech and hearing recognition machines. So everything we're using right now for this podcast would have been part of that, you know, machinery that and software that came out of that time. And so what he often talked about is this connection between intuitive, imaginative creativity and sound itself, and how machines will never be able to capture that, and therefore it would always sound like a machine. And so if you talk to Alexa, you know, you will know exactly what I'm talking about. And meanwhile, during early 70s, you know, his colleagues were convinced that we will have a machine that you will not be able to tell that it's a machine in 10 years. So here we are in 2020, and my father was right.
Yeah, it's amazing how those predictions don't always age well, or a lot of times don't, you know?
Yeah, and so he always considered the dimension of at least humanness about speech, and he considered art to be just as much valid inquiry into reality as science. And in fact, when I told my father that I'm going to try to make it as an artist, you know, after college, he said, well, that's what I wanted to become. And, you know, I'm so glad that you're pursuing a path that I wanted to do, take. And, you know, so I grew up in a very fortunate environment where art was part of life. It was, I just assumed that everybody painted, you know, because that was the case in my house, you know. And I went to middle school in New Jersey and found out that was kind of weird to assume that. But I think I was very fortunate. But my mother was also an educator, and she actually has kept a painting that I did when I was 3 in Sweden, and framed it and gave it to me for my graduation from my college. And she didn't say too much about it. She said, you know, I kept this. Behind that was, I think, proof that she saw something in me very early on. Yeah. And she nurtured that. Mm-hmm. And I still have the painting. I got it back after my mother passed away, you know, and then reframed it, and then found out in the back there were all these notes that my mother made about it. And so she was an educator, and she you know, she had 2 uncles who were artists types. One was a playwright, and one was a fairly well-known painter. And so she saw something in me that you know, for her was important, and she nurtured that, I think, really, really well. So I'm grateful for both of my parents to have, you know, unlike other Asian child, you know, I wasn't pushed into becoming a doctor or lawyer, they really wanted to honor the gift that they felt I had.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I'm always curious when I talk to people from other cultures what their view of vocation is. Because I think in America, we have a specific view of vocation, mostly that leads to success from a monetary perspective, right? Like you go to college to get a good job so that you can like sort of be successful and raise a successful family, right? And that's like what sort of cultural backgrounds did you grow up with when it comes to sort of vocation and the purpose of that?
Yeah, so that's really true. And a lot of people struggle with, you know, music, art, that being non-utilitarian. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, we understand that to be one of the most important human activities, having perhaps no usefulness or even a purpose, but other than that, it gives us joy, and it gives us a way to speak about a deeper humanity.
Right.
And, you know, when you think about education, we have made it such transactional reality, and we no longer think of education as a way to grow a person. Mm-hmm. And yet education should do that, at least that, you know. Yeah. And then perhaps, you know, whether it leads to a certain occupation or not. You know, I sit on the board of the school that I went to, Bucknell University, and we look at these data on education all the time, and you know, it's interesting that you know, I was talking to the dean of engineering, and he was saying that, you know, freshmen coming into Bucknell as an engineering major can no longer assume that by the time he or she graduates, that the training would actually be effective, you know. So I have to look for ways to train my students to think outside the box. And the best way to train my students to think outside the box is to do theater or dance or write poetry or, you know, paint. And so Bucknell has this particular way of creating unique intersections, and students can do that. Engineering students are encouraged, and as hard as their, you know, packed as their schedule may be, to try something in the arts, because engineering is not going to be the same 4 years after you enter college. Mm. And that can be said on many disciplines today. And so if you are utilitarian minded, you're going to lose out in this economy. And yeah. So that's one purposeful utilitarian reason why you should do the non-utilitarian liberal arts and really learn to write poetry and understand, you know, deeper nature of human expression.
Yeah. Well, and you talk about the utilitarianism of our society and how when we are utilitarian, what gets lost is art in all of that, right? Because it is non-utilitarian, right? It's meant to bring about beauty and sort of points to the new creation. Can you just talk about that?
Yeah, so, you know, I used to defend the arts. You know, I was on the National Council, which is the highest position a citizen can serve, the government, the U.S. government, on providing leadership for National Endowment for the Arts and advocating for U.S. arts. And I, you know, I used to go around the country flying around. And in fact, my first book came out of those days when I was traveling a lot. And, you know, you always get stuck in airports. And I learned this discipline of writing while waiting or, you know, flying on the airplane. And I kept on writing short essays, and that became my first book. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I remember one time I was on the airplane writing one of these essays because I had just spoken at an arts council somewhere, and I was thinking about modern dance and how important to preserve modern dance and, you know, how American it is and so forth. And then and all of a sudden it occurred to me that what I was writing about was not so much just advocating for the arts or defending or, you know, supporting artists, but I was actually defending the gospel.
Mm.
And that was a shock in a way. I have to ask myself, is that true? And I said, you know, by that time I was involved in Redeemer church planting team with, you know, under Tim Keller. And I was helping to think creatively about church planting and so forth. And I was doing a lot of missional work. You know, I felt I was called to move my family into New York City so that I can minister directly to artists. And so I was thinking about the gospel a lot. And then I realized, like, you know, if we didn't have the gospel of incarnation, if we didn't have, you know, Jesus being in flesh, you know, being able to show us what a perfect life ought to be, and a death that, you know, gives us life, then there's no reason why we should care about anything other than survival, you know. And what Jesus was invoking was so much out of abundance of God's creation. And then, as you know, it's an invocation into the new creation. And we seem to not capture that portion of the gospel. Mm-hmm. A lot of times it's very utilitarian driven. It's very purposeful. It's like, you know, you will get to heaven, you know, if you believe this and ascend to this, which is not wrong. It's just incomplete. Okay. And so when I spoke to, you know, theologians like Tom Wright, N.T. Wright, or Alan Davis at Duke, when they started writing about, you know, the poetic notion of understanding the Bible is critical, that it's an essence, it's at the heart of Scripture, is poetry and songs and, you know, and certainly hymns, right? And so when I was talking to Tom Wright about this, I think what I say about Scripture, a lot of it's in book, would sound crazy to a normal person because I'm flipping the paradigm to say that no, Bible is in fact about creativity and imagination, the sanctified imagination that leads to new creation. Bible is not about the end of the world or apocalyptic vision of how the world would end. If it's going to end in a certain way, it's going to be a beginning of another. Mm. And so Christians are supposed to be living in that hope, you know, and then building into that hope and making and imagining into that hope. But we don't have that way a lot of times in preaching. You know, it becomes, you know, what I call a very utilitarian way of saying, well, if you believe this, you know, you will go to heaven and you can invite your neighbor to join you. Well, that's not wrong, again, but it's incomplete because it doesn't tell you why you are fixing the pipes and why what is going through the pipes, and, you know, this line of new creation of abundance flowing into us now, right, that we are able to co-create into that reality now, as if there's a deposit, some kind of a deposit made into the new creation. That is not talked about. That, but as an artist reading the Bible, I think about that all the time, and I read it all the time, and I you know, from Genesis to Revelation, the Bible is packed with these observations of how we are to be partakers of the new creation, despite the fact that we're fallen, we are, you know, really traumatized. We have to recover from that, but that all the brokenness is the entry into the new as well. And so I talk a lot about that in the book. But going back to thinking about the arts, I realized that without that perspective of the gospel being in its entirety about not just restoring us, you know, we're not being restored back to Eden. We're being, you know, we're being redeemed to be given authority. You know, Matthew 28, the Great Commission authority is given to us to exercise this, you know, full baptism of our imagination to create into the new. Mm. That's what we're being sent out to do. So proclamation of the gospel, what we call evangelism, has to be tied in with our making. And because we kind of become a very utilitarian way of talking about fixing the world, kind of industrial model, you know, we lost sight of this life-affirming, abundant feast, cosmic wedding, you know, the poetry, dance, you know, music, art, gourmet cooking, you know, all that will be part of the new creation.
Yeah, I very much agree. I just kind of want to applaud like the whole time you were talking, because I like very much agree. You know, it's the new creations are, that's the hope, right? That like, that's the future for us. And to neglect that, I think, is really damaging to I don't know what we should be doing. Do you think because we've gotten so utilitarian, and I love how you talk about plumbing theology in the book, you know, I think that's a great analogy.
With apology to plumbers.
right. But do you think because we have gotten so utilitarian as a culture in general, that we have diminished what creativity even is and relegated it into like only specific places?
Yeah, so, you know, plumbing theology is, you know, when you go to church, you learn new to use new tools, right? You go to Sunday school and they teach you, there's a new tool for you to fix the pipes. And you just keep going back because every week there's a new tool. And then you're supposed to share that new tool with your neighbors. And next time you're supposed to bring that person to the, you know, to be trained to use this tool. But you know, at no point does a person learn anything about why you're fixing the pipes, you know. Right. So you're not quite sure what's going through the pipes to begin with, why the pipes are there to begin with, but you're also not told that, again, the wine of new creation is flowing back to where we are, fallen, you know, human beings, full of anxiety and fear and scarcity. But this abundance is flowing into us through faith. And, we, you know, that's what Jesus was doing on the Sermon on the Mount. You know, he was speaking to people stricken, right, with so many, you know, struggles of survival game that they had to play in the Armageddon Valley of, you know, where Israeli, you know, planes were so, valleys were so contested. Right. Mm. So there was no way you could have any kind of security. You know, we think we have it. We struggle now with anxiety and fear, but I can't imagine being in the first century, living in that place, you know, Nazareth, which is literally called the Armageddon Valley because of the trade route northwest, southeast is converging there, and everybody wanted to fight over your land. And so there was no security, you know, there was no government to protect you if you were a Jewish family. And here's Jesus speaking to them about, you know, look at the birds of the air and consider the lilies of the field. And they must be like, what are you talking about? And then all of a sudden, right, in the mountains where they were, the really hills of Galilee, you know, after it rains, all of a sudden these wildflowers will pop up. You know, I stood there and I'm a bird watcher. And all of a sudden this, I realized that Jordan Basin is the greatest migratory path for birds. Mm. And so there's literally millions of storks flying over you, wow. You know, at certain season, right? And if they make it that far, because the Syrian soldiers use them for target practice. And so if they make it, there are millions, fortunately, still going back and forth. Jesus was talking about, when he said, look at the birds of the air, he was talking about abundance. He was talking about abundance of creation. You know, that has not changed because we have wars and we have famine. So Jesus was saying, remember the abundance of God through, from which you have come. And now there's a problem because we screwed up and, you know, we made things scarce in our lands and we're fighting over it. We're fighting culture wars and we're trying to, you know, win at all costs and we're trying to preserve what we can for our families. But I am here to usher in a new creation. I am the king of new wine, the new creation. So those who follow me can live differently and even face their scarcity-filled land with a different mindset. And so that's the gospel, that's the good news. And so for me, when I see Christians, in a typical fear stance of saying, well, if we don't vote this way, left or right, that you're going to get this and this and this, this fear mongering that is happening and fighting culture wars because we're afraid of what might happen if the wrong candidate gets into the office or, whatever, it was even worse in first century. So, and those who followed Christ had a radically different agenda about the kingdom of God breaking in, that they experienced, and so now we can look back at that history and understand that we can be assured of this. Right, we can have certainty that God is going to, provide for us. Is going to lead us out of the wilderness and the desert into the promised land. Those are things that we don't have to doubt anymore because though that is the narrative. And going back to the story, we tell ourselves if we don't have a way to preach to our hearts and retell our stories. And if we believe that the narrative is culture wars, if this doesn't happen, I am done. That's not true. First of all, that's not true for individuals. That's not true for culture. That's not true for country. But, even if you think that's true, then if we don't re-narrate ourselves to have a transcendent perspective, we're going to be so narrowly locked in on what we discard. And what we believe that it's no longer faith. It's something else. And it's Bible calls it idol making, but it creates a paradigm where there's no win situation.
Yeah, totally agree with that. And just pushing back on the culture. I mean, isn't art or isn't creating beauty like countercultural act in and of itself?
Yeah, it is because it is useless, and yet it's because it's not useful, it's essential. And I try to tell people this to a non-artist, they say, what are you talking about? I say, well, when you look back on your life, what are, name three things that you remember that you would take to your deathbeds, right? And they may name one or two. And they say, well, there was this time when I had this conversation with my daughter. There was this, I remember looking at the sunset, in Arkansas, and all of a sudden this thing, opened up to me. I realized who I was or whatever. And then I asked them, are those things in any way useful or utilitarian? Can you market those things? Right. Can you put it in a package and market it? Well, this is what marketers are trying to do all the time. but you really can't, right? That's why it's so attractive to marketers, because they can't capture the most important things that are non-utilitarian, right? And so when we look back on our lives, and certainly when we go through a pandemic, shutdown, and we have to reflect on those things. We really have to ask ourselves, what's really important to us? Is it like having all these cars in the garage, having multiple houses, having success, resumeable things? So these are things that we are told are most important. But when you think about any person thinking about their lives will say, no, that's not what I will remember. That's not going to be important to me, on my deathbed. Right. I'm going to remember that conversation with my daughter when I had no hope, and somehow your daughter speaks like an angel, back to you. So I'm going to remember that time that I spent with my family, at a beach or pond or whatever. And so if that's true, then how do we, right, as Christians, be able to bring that reality of transcendence and hope into our lives, right? How do we, and the Bible is full of these moments, yeah, right? Yeah. So, and yet our preaching has become, you know, notably about power, about, you know, winning, about, you know, being prosperous, about the gaining, amassing success, like okay, resumeable success, which is the opposite, you know, of what we call the fruit of the Spirit abundance, the life with a capital L. So what are we preaching, right? And so these are things that I note as an artist. I have a contrarian mind, so I always kind of flip things over, but you know, when I thought about it back again to the airplane ride when I was writing and I was thinking modern dance, and all of a sudden I was like, no, this is about the gospel. You know, the reason why we dance, because we serve the Lord of the dance. That's the only reason, really. I mean, people who don't understand that will still dance, because it's embedded in them that dancing can somehow bring out the, you know, best of us. But for Christians, that's like, wow, you know, we have the paradigm, right, to go back to and say affirmatively with certitude that this is the reason why we live, you know, like art is connected with our lives, and faith is connected with both art and life in a significant way. And if we can begin to understand the Bible through those lens of creativity, imagination, you know, making, then we may not have to be so caught up in our minute particulars of differences in theology, of arguing over which ideology is, you know, correct. Those things are important. I'm not saying they're not, but we can back end into them and make that the last thing we talk about rather than the first.
I think that's good. That's really good. You're making me just really miss, like, one of the things I miss most about, like, in-person worship is, like, yeah, playing guitar and like worshiping with my hands up and like people around, like, and I think that's like what you're describing, you know, David dancing before the ark, right? I mean, like, that is just like an overflow.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't worship like that.
but it shows the abundance and exuberance, and it also unfortunately shows a response, right? That people were ashamed that he was doing this, and I think that's what we miss, is the in-person worship is the intangibles, right? Yeah. It's the those things are not necessary, you know, you can't package that, right. and these things come out of us almost improvisationally, yeah, on the spot. You know, and there's no two, you may be singing the same Hillsong over and over, but, you know, it's not the same, because the audience is different, you're different. And so instead of homogenizing that, how can we capture that, you know, the moment when Spirit speaks through us?
Yeah, there's almost a real simplicity to it, because it's not the big things. It's not the life-altering, world-changing, powerful events. It's the, like, mundane, and it's the simple, I guess. I don't know a better word.
Yeah, you know, so I've experienced many times, you know, and I mean, we have these mega churches and spectacles all over the place, and I don't doubt that God can use that, but I often wonder, you know, what happens, you know, when a 10 people, when a group of 10 people and a pastor simply begins to worship in spirit and truth, mm-hmm, and allow the Holy Spirit to take over spontaneously and improvisationally, as well as liturgically and, you know, systematically. And, you know, what can happen in a small group where things can be deadly honest and authentic, you know, and I wonder if that's kind of the antidote, especially when I think about what I miss, you know, during the shutdown. I do crave that more than, let's say, you know, going to a giant stadium, you know, 50,000 people worshiping. That would be fantastic. But maybe there's an intimacy to just, you know, your small group worshiping together, that, you know, and then eating together, and, you know, and that may bring more joy to my soul right now, you know.
Yeah, I totally agree. Do you feel like, I mean, you talked about your art being called slow art. Do you feel like that's what your art brings into the equation? Some of that sort of like, it's not like it cannot be rushed, right? There's right. no rushing right. it whatsoever. Is that the aspect that some of that brings into?
Yeah, and I think, you know, faith is slow faith.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And so there's no package that, you know, program that can speed up the process. It seems like, you know, once you learn something, you feel like you're starting back at, you know, starting point, because, you know, the more I learn about the God that I love, the less I understand the mystery to God's presence. Yeah. And yet, the intimacy that I feel, the, you know, the Holy Spirit invading into my studio, my practice of making art, has the awareness of that and the joy of that has only increased, you know, over time. And but intellectually, I'm like, I don't understand this. You know, like, how could this? You know, it's like paradoxes everywhere. You know, so I feel like, well, maybe that's part of the journey, and I'm supposed to, you know, as I have reflected, and this intersection between my art and my faith has overlapped, I'm beginning to realize, like, no, it's a long, slow road, and yet there is hope and there is assurance, you know, assurance of things hopeful, because I'm not alone in that journey. And I'm also guided by every step of the way, right? The things that I do know, and I have love, I have come to love, you know, my relationships and materials that I use, and there's a liturgical rhythm to that. And you know, you almost don't need to be able to see with the eyes of your heart, you know, to understand, hear the kingdom footsteps, because those are things that, you know, you come to after a long, long journey.
Yeah, I think we need to hear that. The faith is slow, because it can be so frustrating, right? Like,
right.
We want one, two, like, steps, you know what I mean? Like, tangible steps, and then it's done.
And that's part of the industrial mode, you know. We want step-by-step, you know, manual, right? Yeah. And we think the Bible is that. Right. So we create these, like, you know, extra booklets on these steps, right? Yeah. And that becomes our ministries and so forth. But again, there's nothing wrong with, you know, trying to do that, because we are trying to understand it rationally and pragmatically. But if we think that's the only way, then that can create you know, kind of this idol identity or whatever we struggle with. And so this roundabout ways of how the Spirit leads us, and how the Bible is not a manual, but it is poetry, it is art, it is a song, it is, you know, it is a narrative full of mystery, you know. Mm-hmm. and if we begin to harness that creativity and imagination, you know, in a way that is sanctified rather than selfish self-expression, you know, we will understand this journey a little bit better, and we might be able to invite people who don't see it, right, who cannot understand rationally how Christian faith can in any way help the world.
Yeah.
And yet I've had conversations, you know, artists are so used to failing over and over that that's just normative, right? And, you know, I always laugh when, you know, people say, well, you know, we don't, typically what happens in a church or any pragmatic institution is that, you know, you come up with an idea and they say, well, we don't have a budget for that. And artists are like, I've never had a budget for that. That's like an assumed reality. You know, like if you say I have like $5 for this, I'll be like amazed. I'll be like, oh my gosh, you know, that's more than I ever had for my idea. So you know, so I have to kind of say to them, look, this doesn't require money. This does not require budget. It takes priority, it takes sacrifice, but no, I'm used to that, right? So artists are used to fading over and over, right? And so they, when I speak to them about faith, you know, and typically they've had negative experience, you know, with religion or church. So you don't even want to go there. But you know, if you could, you find out like what happened. Yeah. And a lot of times I talk to artists and they've been abused.
Yeah.
No wonder they don't want to go to church. I understand that. You know, I feel like I went through very similar things with institutions and so forth. So I understand that. But the most important thing is like, what do you see as a possibility of hope in this dying world to give hope, you know, in some way? And they're like completely with me. With, you know, they want to know about Jesus because they know that Jesus is safe. Religion is dangerous, but Jesus is safe. So they'll talk for hours and hours about what they feel that Jesus can bring into the world, you know, and even through them sometimes, even though they've rejected their faith, right? Mm-hmm. So this kind of conversation is like reminding me, you know, going back to, you know, how we might talk about the church or institution, or, you know, how especially after this pandemic, it's like we have this understanding of brokenness, and we have this book about failures leading to new creation.
Yeah.
And brokenness and wounds and, you know, ground zero experiences and all of that, right? And yet we don't speak about it in a way that it can be heard by people who have already experienced that.
Yeah, I think that's really good. And I think that's a great segue into, because I think in your book, you talk about kintsugi,
yes,
correct? Right. Which, right. I mean, is brokenness and art together. Right. So can you talk about the book? And yeah.
So kintsugi is this venerable tea tradition that really harkens back to 15th, 16th century thereabouts. It originated in other cultures, but it ended in Japan. And tea masters of Japan, when the ceramic teaware breaks because of earthquakes and whatnot, family or tea masters would often keep the broken ceramics for several generations, and they give it to a Japan lacquer master to do kintsugi, kintsugi master. Kintsugi is mending with gold. So you use Japan lacquer to mend, put the pieces back together, but then you accentuate the fractures rather than hiding them. So you put gold oftentimes in between the cracks or on Japan lacquer. And so it looks like a golden river or a mountain, or, you know, it began this whole new way of looking at brokenness. So I launched this thing called Kintsugi Academy, working with a Kintsugi master who had a very unique experience. Kintsugi has been a secret tradition for centuries. And part of that is because Japan lacquer is so hard to master. Japan lacquer is made from poison sumac. So one-third of the population is highly allergic. Japan lacquer master, urushi master, is someone that has developed kind of this, you know, tolerance for poison sumac and can layer these, you know, basically you have to kind of breathe in as well as touch it. So it's kind of crazy. But anyways, it developed into its own craft form. And so they have been doing kintsugi. And so no one knew how they were doing it, right? Because they were doing it as part of their craft. And Master Nakamura, this young kintsugi master, after 3/11/2011 disaster in Japan, the Tohoku Great Earthquake and tsunamis, where fishing villages were washed away and children were orphaned in their grade schools, with their entire generation, their parents, their grandparents, all washed away. He wanted to bring kintsugi to these children and the victims. And so he said, well, I can't bring poison sumac to them. So he worked with a manufacturer, fishing rod manufacturer, to create a new urushi based on cashew nuts to so that children can handle them. And he taught them how to do kintsugi, not just to do, you know, mend their toys and broken rice balls that they found at their homes or whatever. He taught them how to man. And out of that came these stories, incredible stories of people, you know, victims of these earthquakes, finding hope in the rubbles, right? And so I brought him to Nashville and Princeton and New York and I in LA and Sundance. And I wanted him to, you know, teach us how to do this. And we now have these kits that anybody can use to do, you know, anybody can learn to do kintsugi. And so we've been teaching in this time of shutdown, training leaders so that they can create these pods of workshops and so forth in their communities. You know, kind of I'm using everything I learned about church planting.
This kintsugi account. It all comes full circle.
Right. And it's wonderful. But you know, it's something that anybody can do. And again, going back to what we were talking about, when you start to use your hands, you know, to start to mend, and anybody can do this. So you know, people are coming in like, oh, I never done anything like this, and it's fine. You know, I'll give you something to just play with. You know, and they start using their hands. All of a sudden, I think psychiatry friend told me, trauma counselor told me that actually there are new neurons being created when you do that, and it makes sense because their demeanor changes, and they start talking about their traumas. You know, all of a sudden, like, out of nowhere, and something gets triggered, and then, you know, then you're using gold to touch it up, and the resulting, when you see that, it's literally as if your heart has begun to mend, and the healing start to take place, and you now have a complete, you know, community around you who you didn't know before, but because you have been so honest about your experience, you know, you share that with the others. And I've been doing this in remote sessions. Same thing happens. It's amazing. You know, these people are all around United States or Canada, and they're sharing their experiences, and it's as if they're together in one room, you know. And so I've been doing that. And kintsugi is, I have a chapter in my book, a kintsugi chapter, because that is literally the perfect metaphor for new creation, right? Yeah. So you start with something and it breaks, right? And you end up with this beautiful redesigned bowl, but the kintsugi bowl is more valuable than the original,
right?
That's a new creation.
Yeah.
And we remember that Jesus' wounds, nail marks, are still with him in post-resurrection. And so out of, you know, through his wounds, we are healed. So we might speculate that whatever we're going through is also sanctified in new creation as markers of light breaking through the fractures of our lives. And we are being mended by the Kintsugi Master, Jesus, to find hope through our brokenness, you know, and through our times of desperate cries, that God will somehow even be present in that to create something new, and we are more valuable than when we first began.
Yeah. So good. So hope-filled, especially right now. We just need some hope, you know? And I think that's beautiful. So, Marco, do you feel like we've covered the book in ways that are helpful and all of that?
Yeah, I think so. I'm so grateful for Tom Wright, N.T. Wright, to have written the foreword. I was hoping for a little paragraph, you know, and he wrote a whole treatise. That alone is worth the price of the book. I'm creating these study guides with my colleagues and doing Kintsugi as part of that, Kintsugi Academy. So, you know, any listener interested, I'm easy to find online. I'm on every social media and so forth. So please give me a shout out. And I want to especially serve pastors through this time. I know it's been hard for many of my pastor friends. And, you know, this has been a difficult challenge going through this pandemic. But there is going to be an end to this. And when the pandemic lifts in some way, at least be manageable, you know, we're going to need you, and we're going to need pastors who can literally be the Kintsugi master for their communities. So let me know how I can serve you.
That's good. I love that. Well, do you have time for my two final quick questions here at the end? Okay. So my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
Yeah, that's a great question. I had to think about that one. And I did many little jobs, right? As an artist, you have to survive.
Sure.
And probably the one most interesting one was cleaning the cages of squirrel monkeys at Bucknell Animal Behavior Lab.
Wow.
As work study to do research on them, right? So because the art barn was next to the Animal Behavior Lab, you know, I ended up spending a lot of time there sketching Japanese macaques and squirrel monkeys, and then you know, I had a job cleaning the cages, right? So you know, I was there all the time, and actually it was great, because you know, I ended up with double major eventually, but that kept me going. And then my fascination with birds and animals and ecology continues to really inform me, so I'm grateful.
That's awesome. That's a great way to, you know, get that taken care of and like find new beauty in different places. So yeah, that's awesome. I love that. Okay. So then my final question is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
So, you know, I have spent a lot of time with people like Miroslav Volf, who led the study on work and faith, David Miller, who at Princeton, who's one of my closest friends, who talks a lot about work and faith. And number one thing that David says is that, you know, work is not a curse. You know, people think work is part of the curse after the fall, you know, but it's not. You know, the serpent is cursed, but not the ground is cursed, but not work. Work is a way to honor God. And every work, whether it be my work as an artist or my bride who's an attorney with Embers International, and she advocates for, you know, these former sex slave children, and she considers her work, you know, representing a company to a judge, as you know, there's a complete and secure realm, just as important, right? Just as noble, just as sacred, right? And I think so our perspective has to shift to say, you know, what I do, whatever you're doing as a plumber, is sacred. It's a sacred calling, and I need to honor God today with the best of my ability to bring the best service to honor people that I work with, to, you know, customers. Everything is like paramount, more important than the check that I will receive. And I know people are doing that. The reason why I know is because there are thousands of frontline workers today in hospitals doing this. They don't get paid that much, but they're risking their lives to serve people, you know, so that they will have hope. That's incredible to me, right? So if they can do that, you know, it doesn't matter if we're, and the postal workers, right? Like they're risking their lives so we can get my Amazon package. Like, what is that, right? And that there's something about that's remarkable to me, and that gives me hope that, you know, all of us, right? Whether it be Wall Street, to, you know, hospital care workers, to garbage collectors, you know, like we can all see ourselves that way, you know, that as, no, this is noble. You know, I'm not doing this for money only, you know, I need to pay rent, but, you know, I have, you know, this calling today to serve my people. And I think that shift in mindset, And by the way, I think that's the shift that makes us an artist, you know, artist of the kingdom. Well, I'm not painting, so I can sell my work, you know. You know, some of the monumental, it's like impossible, right? But I'm hoping that through what I do, if I can do it faithfully, that people will see the impossible be part of their lives, and that they can, you know, grow with it. And respond to that with their own impossibilities becoming, you know, possible. So those are, you know, that's why my recent work's called Walking on Water, because I really want people to be able to harness and experience that. So,
yeah, I love that. And that is such good advice. Marco, I can't say thanks enough for coming and making time for me. This has been awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah
let me know how I can serve you further.
Oh, thanks so much. Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Marco. I also hope this episode pushed you in new ways around art and faith and the necessity of art. I got so much out of this interview just thinking about why art, why beauty, why bring beauty into this world, especially as Christians. Like, these are really important topics, and I think we can be very counterculture in the way that we care about beauty, because we have a creator who's good and cares about good things. And so I just hope this pushes you. Check out Mako's book. It's awesome. I have everything linked below. Just really great stuff. If you can, I always appreciate you leaving a rating and review for the podcast. It just helps get the word out about Theology of Hustle. Also, just share this episode. I would love for other people to get to hear these words of encouragement, and maybe these words of pushing them further in their thinking about art and the necessity of art. So, subscribe, rate, review, and share, and I appreciate it. And until next time, get out there and hustle.